You have a phone? My phone talks. You might want to turn it down. Okay, so Leviticus is not where we are. 1 Samuel is somewhere where we are. 1 Samuel chapter 6. I don't have any idea why I said Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 6. Just as a little bit of review, I did it again. I'm not sure what's going on there. But you understand. 1 Samuel chapter 6. The ark is returned to Israel. Verse 17, the golden tumors which the Philistines returned for a guilt offering to the Lord, one for Ashdod, Gaza, Ashkelon, one for Gath and Ekron. Then, in verse 19, he struck down, this is the Lord, he struck down some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked into the ark of the Lord. He struck down of all the people 50,070 men. And the people mourned because the Lord struck the people with a great slaughter. The men of Bathsheba said, "Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall he go up from us?" So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have brought back to the ark of God, the Lord. Come down and take it up to you." So they come down and take it up to them. We're going to start by making the same point that George made last week. George, do you remember the point you made from here last week?
So many good points.
And humble, too. Okay. When the ark was in the land of the Philistines, what happened? It came to one city and killed many people. And what did they do? Send it to another city. Exact same thing happens here. George, what excellent point did you make last week from this?
Well, I called it hard, and then I was saying that, that God was just across the board. You can see it.
Whether it's his people or not. So something we can learn from this. People now, I mean, there are different aspects we can look at this from, and I'm looking at it from in this next point. A dispensational premillennialist says, what about the Israelites? Oh, they are the nation, the chosen nation. They were better. They are better. Everything is better. But a couple things. Number one, they weren't any better. But the Jews were never absolutely, that is, apart from everyone else in every way, special. In fact, in the most important way, they were and are exactly the same. If you're disobedient to the Lord, you die. It's the same. And from this we learned what George, a point he made, God is not one to show partiality. Some of your versions may say he's not a respecter of persons, right? But in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him. Here's an illustration of that. That applies even to the Jews then, and now it even applies to Christians, the Christian nation, those who are of the Christians who are fearing him and doing what is right are welcome to him. All right, so chapter 7. The men of Kiriath-Jearim come and took the ark, and it's there for 20 years and 7 months, really. Then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, "If you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you. Direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, and he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines." Now, do you remember their question in chapter 4? The Philistines come and wipe them out. And their first question is, why? Yeah, why did God allow this to them? And what was their answer? They didn't have the ark. Here's the real answer. Well, if you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, he'll deliver you. So evidently that was the problem back then, right? All right. Verse 4, so the sons of Israel removed the Baals and the Ashtaroth and served the Lord alone. Then Samuel said, "Gather all Israel to Mizpah and I will pray to the Lord for you." They gathered to Mizpah, drew water and poured it out before the Lord and fasted on that day and said there, "We have sinned against the Lord." And Samuel judged the sons of Israel at Mizpah. Now when the Philistines heard that the sons of Israel had gathered to Mizpah, the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. And when the sons of Israel heard it, they were afraid of the Philistines. Then the sons of Israel said to Samuel, "Do not cease to cry to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines." Samuel took a suckling lamb, offered it for a whole burnt offering to the Lord? And Samuel cried to the Lord for Israel. And the Lord answered him. Now Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. But the Lord thundered with a great thunder that day against the Philistines and confused them so that they were routed before Israel. The men of Israel went out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines and struck them down as far as below as Beth-Kar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shen and named it Ebenezer, saying, "Thus far the Lord has helped us." So the Philistines were subdued, and they did not come anymore within the border of Israel. Okay. Israel and their Ebenezer. The first thing about this, Ebenezer is the name of the place where 20 years and 7 months ago, Israel first fought, at this occasion, first fought against the Philistines. That's chapter 4, verse 1. The Philistines take the ark from Ebenezer, chapter 5, verse 1. There at Ebenezer, the Israelites brought the ark, thinking that the ark itself was their Ebenezer. What does Ebenezer mean? Rock of good hope. Something like that. My version, stone of help. It's what my version's footnote is. Something like that, right? So, finally, here in chapter 7, they take... Verse 12, Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shen and named it Ebenezer, saying, "Thus far the Lord has helped us." Let me ask you a question. Was the stone itself actually their Ebenezer? No. Right. So what was their Ebenezer? The Lord. Yeah. Not the Christ yet. Right. The Lord is. Now, we sing a song, "Here I..." And exactly, right out of here, out of the somewhat of a translation of the King James Version of what it says here. What song is that?
Oh, that's Found for Every Blessing.
Yeah, what number?
520.
So 520, let's take a look at that real quick, because it is a fantastic 420.
I was going to say, I thought it started with 4, but...
Yep, 420. 420, right. O thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing, call for songs of loudest praise. This guy, this woman, or this guy, is saying... So I was looking at a song today, two songs that were written by a woman, so that's... Okay, so this person is saying, look, I want my life and my thoughts to be in line with the Lord's. Why? Because of His mercy, they call for songs of loudest praise. You think of what God has done for you, and you say, that's worth shouting about. Teach me ever to adore Thee. May I still Thy goodness prove, while the hope of endless glory fills my heart with joy and love. Here I raise my Ebenezer. Hither by Thy help I've come. So, he's saying, look, I am saved. This is where I'm right now. I'm only saved by the grace of God. And I hope by thy good pleasure safely to go to heaven, safely to arrive at home. Jesus sought me when a stranger, wandering from the fold of God. He, to rescue me from danger, interposed his precious blood. There's the gospel story. Now, oh, to grace how great a debtor daily I'm constrained to be. Listen, let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Never let me wander from thee. Never the God I love. He's saying, look, I don't ever want to leave God. I don't want to. The next part, the last, is so beautiful. Here's my heart. Oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. This person is coming to God and saying, God, I love you. I was a sinner. The only way I am the way I am is because of what you had done. Here's the gospel story. And then God, please protect me because I want to spend my life with you. How beautiful is that? And in that is, here is, I raise my, figuratively speaking, of course, my Ebenezer. Now, here's a question for you. Do you think the Jews would have sung this song when they first encountered the Philistines? Would they have, or maybe not this song, but obviously they couldn't have sang this one because it was written in whatever. Yeah. But wouldn't they have... Do you think the sentiments that are in this song, do you think they would have sung it? I have some no's. I'm guessing they would have. I mean, who wouldn't sing that song?
God brought them out of Egypt.
Right.
And they were there by His grace.
And I'm not even talking about the faithful. I'm talking about just the Israelites. Would they sing that song? I'm guessing. Now, of course, this is speculation, but I'm guessing, of course, they would. I mean, a Jew is God's person, and they're going to sing songs about God, right? So maybe there's a little bit of a jump there. But did even if they would have sung that song, would singing that song have helped them? No. Right. Exactly. If you want God to work in your life, then singing songs is what you need to do. No, right. Zealously singing won't do it. Intense feelings of faith won't do it. Grand confessions of faith won't do it. Showing up at camp won't. Look at that in chapter 4, verse 1, when Samuel came to Israel. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle and camped beside Ebenezer. This is actually a point for all of us, but I'm going to speak specifically to the younger generation right now. Who here has been to camp? I remember when I was in sixth grade, I went to FC camp in New Jersey. So I went to camp. And who else has been to camp? How do you feel? Let me tell you, do you sing zealously while you're at camp? I'm guessing you do. I might be wrong. Do you have intense feelings of faith? Yes, you do. He's shaking. He's the most recent one to be at camp. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with camp, by the way. Confessions of faith, sometimes, but that's the whole point of being there, saying, look, I love the Lord, right? Now, is there anything wrong with that? Obviously not. That's fantastic. We need those things. But those things alone won't help you. How did these people finally please God? Chapter 7, verse 4, the sons of Israel removed the Baals and the Ashtaroth and served the Lord alone. They got rid of their sin. You want the Lord to work in your life. The first thing you have to do is get rid of your sin. Then verse 5, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. So they gathered, they drew water, they poured it out before the Lord. I don't understand that. I get the point, though. They were showing some kind of remorse before the Lord. And they fasted on that day. They said, we have sinned against the Lord. The Philistines heard of it, and the sons of Israel, they were afraid. Verse 8, the sons of Israel said to Samuel, do not cease to cry out to the Lord. Verse 9, Samuel took, and he offered a sacrifice. You see, and then, after all this, that's when the Lord finally saved them. Okay? So, just be aware that zealously singing is good. We need to. If you're not, there's a problem. Right? Intense feelings of faith? We need them. But these things alone, just going to camp, as it were, they're not going to do it. Comments or questions on what we've talked about here so far?
Yeah, the thing about the stone here, what is it that you think separates that from a religious icon or thou shalt make no graven image? Here he is raising a stone that is to remind them of something. What do you think are the things that separate this? This isn't a condemned sort of thing here.
No. Right, this would be just like any other. They put a pile of stones in the middle of the Jordan. I think the difference is if they started carrying this stone around with them like they did the ark. They turned the ark into an icon. So putting the faith in the stone as opposed to the God behind it. Maybe I'll answer part of your question with, does Litas, do you think it's wrong to wear a cross around the neck? Not necessarily. You throw something at me if you'd like to. But does Litas, do you think it's wrong to say, okay, I'm all right because I wear a cross around my neck? Yes. I don't know if that... What are you thinking?
Well, there are things that separate it. One of them, did not become an object of worship.
Like Nehushtan.
Like an icon does in the Greek Orthodox or something
right.
like that, or Russian Orthodox.
The snake that Moses wrapped around, the Nehushtan they call it later on. Right. It was okay, but they turned it into... Yeah. Did I hear something? Okay. All right. By the way, verse 10 in this chapter 7. Now Samuel, verse verse 10. Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. The King James Version says, as, the New King James does too, right? As Samuel was offering. The NIV says, while Samuel was offering. The ESV and the New American Standard don't bring out that, but it's in there. You know, he's offering, what does it say? Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. The point is he's doing the offering, and here they're coming. Now, the question is this. Was Israel tempted to doubt God? I mean, that's like kind of late in the game. Okay, I got one more thing for you to do, and here they're coming. They're knocking on the door, and God is saying, and Samuel is offering a sacrifice. I mean, that's, you're done with the time for sacrifice. You're supposed to be picking up the swords and running after them by then. But yet, what are they still doing? Offering the sacrifice. Were they tempted? Do you remember somebody else who was in this situation? Six chapters later. That took a long time. Samson, Saul. Remember? In fact, turn that. 1 Corinthians, Samuel 13. 1 Samuel 13. This is when he's first king. Verse 5. The Philistines assembled to fight Israel. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and camped in Michmash, east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves, in thickets, in cliffs, in cellars, and pits. And some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan and ran away with their tails between their legs. Verse 8, he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering. And Saul said, and you know the rest of the story. Here they're coming, they're coming, they're marching up here. Okay, here's the point. Whether or not the Israelites were tempted here in chapter 7, I don't know. But they didn't have to be, did they? Because we know the rest of the story. Here comes the Philistines, and you'd think they'd be getting ready for war. Here they're coming. And God, what does it say? He confused them. He took care of it. So whether or not Israel was tempted to doubt God, they didn't have to be, as the short story shows. And they weren't, which means that they held their faith, doesn't it? You have no job. And the bills are piling up. What do you do? Here's two scenarios. You at the last minute take an compromising job, or you wait through the last minute in faith. You get the idea of what we're talking about here. Which is the high road? Which is the road that God wants you to take? Here come the Philistines. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And they stuck it out, waited it out, right? Here's one that is, it's difficult to ask, but you meet someone at the door who asks, where's your wife or child? And they want to harm your wife or child. What do you do? Lie and say she or he or she is not home? Or you wait through the last minute in faith? You get the point of what I'm talking about here. Now, I'll tell you, we shouldn't lie. I don't know what I would do in that situation. I'll put myself there and say I wouldn't know, but I know what I shouldn't do. Right? And the issue, again, is faith. You have no spouse, but oh, so lonely. And there are no strong Christians available in the immediate facility. No strong Christians available. You take matters in your own hands and pursue a relationship with a non-Christian or a weak Christian, or you wait through to the last minute in faith. What do all these have in common? Question of faith.
Wait on the Lord.
Wait on the Lord. And these last, the spouse one here, we're not guaranteed a spouse. We're not even guaranteed protection. We are supposed to have a job. God says provide, so that means you're supposed to have a job, right? So these are even less significant, but yet these are the situations we find ourselves in all the time. But wait, here come the Philistines. Boy, oh boy, shouldn't we be picking up our swords and going to battle? Let's do this first. Let's take care of God's business first. And they're trusting in the Lord. Comments or questions here? Okay. We'll move on to the next chapter. Chapter 8. Do we want to go over the questions comments or questions on the questions? Yes?
I have a question about 4b. What are the prophets being called? What nuances is emphasized? They're called seers. No idea what you meant by the second part, what you were getting at.
Well, what I was thinking is they can see things that we cannot, that most of them couldn't see. Otherwise, they all would have been called seers, or none of them would have been called seers. So just revealing mysteries. Revealing the unseen is what I was getting at. That's all.
Never mind. I might ask you later, but I have a suspicion if the answer is yes, and I'll look really stupid.
So. Okay. By all means, let's not ask that question then. Anybody else a question about the questions? And some of them we'll cover here. All right. We are transitioning from... There are three major portions of the book of 1 Samuel. The first major portion is Samuel's rule. The second major portion is instituting a monarchy. That's where we are. That will only be five chapters. Okay. When it came about, when Samuel was old, that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abijah. They were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. You fill in the rest of the expression. Like father, like son, right?
Not always.
Right. Like father, not necessarily like son. The apple does not necessarily fall near the tree. Some sons are the spitting image of their father. Other sons spit at the image of their father. Right? The point here is, don't judge usually a grown-up child. Don't judge the parents by a grown-up child. Usually you can, but not always, right? Usually it's, if you train up a child in the way they should go when they're young, then they'll always go that way. But not always. So we can't always say, oh, what are their parents messed up totally. At the same time, this does go both ways. Some parents are hideous, but their children turn out to be faithful and godly. Gary, I know you're chomping at the bit to say something.
Well, this is interesting because you just came off the story of Eli.
Yeah.
Just came off the story of Eli, and here's Samuel. So I have to conclude that Samuel, sharply, as much as he had authority to do, rebuked those young men for their actions.
One would hope so. Yes.
I would have to.
Right.
You would have to come to that conclusion. Otherwise, you couldn't, because. No.
Yeah. And what happened? So we have what comes around goes around, right? All right, so then the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them." Now, you might recall Deuteronomy 17. "When you enter into the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, you shall say, 'I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me.' You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your countrymen you shall set as king over yourselves. You shall not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Moreover, he shall not multiply your horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Since the Lord has said to you, 'You shall never again return that way,' he shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver or gold for himself. Now be that when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of the law," so on and so forth. Well, wait a minute. You know what I'm going to ask?
This is what I would ask at this time.
Go ahead, you ask.
So that means Israel had to ask for a king?
Why does he get upset in 1 Samuel chapter 8?
Why is who upset?
Well, Samuel.
Yeah, because they rejected God. Well, they're in a sense rejecting him too.
You're right, they're rejecting both. So, why is it that God says they're rejecting me, when he's the one that said, you're going to ask for a king. Actually, yeah, go ahead. How did they ask for it? Right. Two times they say that. In chapter 8, verse 4. Appoint a king for us to judge us like God told us that he would and he promised us and we just want to do what's according to his plan. No. Like all the nations. Verse 19. No, but there shall be a king over us so that we may do exactly what God says because we just want to follow his plan all the time. No, again. Because they want to be like all the nations. That's what I come up with. The problem with this. Was there anything wrong with them asking for a king? No.
The reason.
Right, which emphasizes the point.
Purpose
nice job. Right? Purpose matters. Look, he said, you're going to have a king. So I don't know how that all worked out, but when they finally asked for a king, they asked for the wrong reason. They say, give us a king because we want to be like the nations. Purpose matters, right? Dear God, please give me a high-paying job, a successful career. Now, we don't say the rest of it. Sometimes we don't even say anything else. Please give me I would like God a successful career. Period. Why? So that I can enjoy everything that America has to offer in this world? How many times do we see that? How many times do we think it? Or that's what we really mean? Is it okay to ask God for riches? Well, 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9 says God gives us riches so that we will be able to help others. So, I'd be careful.
Yeah, Timothy tells us to be content.
With what we have. Yeah. Right.
He doesn't say ask more.
No, James, though, says, look, God would give it to you if you asked for the right reason. Maybe. Not a guarantee. Yes, be content. I'm not saying to pray. And if you're going to pray for riches, that better be for the right reason. Sincerely for the right reason. Right? Purpose matters. Here's another one. Dear God, please make me very smart so I can get into a good university. What should we do if we're very smart? I tell you what. I have a slow processor and horrible RAM. And I have always wanted more RAM and a faster processor. I'm 40 now. It ain't coming. But if I had it, what should I do with it? I should be better prepared to always give a defense for the hope that is in me, right? That's what we need to do with these things. Now, go to a good university. Amen. Get yourself an education so that you can more thoroughly refute the quacks out there and be more ready for it, whatever you got to do. But whatever you pray for, is it bad to pray for intelligence? No. But purpose matters, right? Dear God, please give me talent and crafts so that I can win at the local fair next year. You know, I've not actually been in the presence of somebody while they're praying this, but I've heard firsthand accounts of people praying that they would win a sports game. High schoolers, Christians praying, may we win this basketball game. Okay, why? I don't know. I mean, I guess there's room for it, but man alive, is it? It's borderline, right? Remember, purpose matters. Comments or questions here?
Really sad to see how trapped we are in this mentality still. You know, you've got two points up here. The first one about the fathers and the sons, and we see this with the prophets and with the kings and with the patriarchs over and over and over again, where even when you got a good one, the child training didn't happen and the next generation was destroyed. You have some sons spitting image of their fathers, other sons spitting image. I was thinking there was a lot of the Bible that were actually both.
Yeah.
You know. And then in this situation here, the second one, you know, looking around the rest of the world, what mistakes have they made that we can make too now? Mm-hmm. You know, we've saved ourselves from this for how long? You know, by whose grace? And mm-hmm. They tried and it didn't work, so let's do that, you know. And, mm-hmm. You know, it's a discouraging place to be.
And what is all this? All this, especially this, I'm going to bring up the basketball one again. And that is missing the point of God's power.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, when our Christianity is there, then we need to go back to Christianity 101. You know, this God saved us from our sins, right? Comments? Questions? Okay. So, they've rejected me from being king over them. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day I brought them out of Egypt. God says, this is no big surprise to me, and anybody with a brain shouldn't be a surprise. Verse 9, now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of him a king. He said, this will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take. And you can stop there.
And keep taking.
And he's not going to stop taking until he has taken themselves. He is going to take your sons, place them for himself in his chariots among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots, and he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands, fifties, and some do his plowing, some reap his harvest, some make weapons of war and equipments of chariot. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants. He will also take your male servants and your female servants and your best men and your donkeys and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. Then you will cry out the day because of the king to whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. And nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there will be a king over us so that we may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. Now after Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them to the Lord. He repeated them in the Lord's hearing. And the Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and appoint them a king. So Samuel said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city. What? Foolish, foolish people. Does it get any more foolish than that? Don't miss this point. God will give you what you want. So if God will give you what you want, if you have something, what does that mean? It came from God. You get what you want. And if you have something, then you have what you wanted. If God gives you what you want, the question is, do you want what is foolish? They wanted what is foolish. And they got it. So you'll get what you want. Make your mind up.
The only good thing that happened is this, is the very, very beginning, the elders that came to Samuel recognized that his sons were not up to the task. that was it.
Yep.
It was like their first baby step in this whole thing. Whoa.
They diagnosed.
Samuel's old, and his sons aren't up to it. We've got to do something else. And from right that moment on, boom.
They diagnosed accurately. The prescription? Wrong. Yeah, it's the only good thing that happened.
It took them a long time to figure this out because, you know, we often think of Solomon's days as glory days.
Yeah.
There were people that were slaves to Solomon. And then how much
when Rehoboam and Jeroboam.
They were tired.
Yeah.
When Rehoboam came to the throne, they're like, you know, we can't take this anymore.
Right.
You know, and then verse 10 there, or verse 18, you know, you're in front of me, and God's going to like, I'm not listening. I'm not going to hear you. You asked for this. Back in 8 there, you know, when he summarized what they've been like, you know, stubborn and rebellious people, basically.
Verse 8.
How many times
did
he use that phrase in the first 5 books of the Bible? You know, stubborn and rebellious people, or Exodus.
A few comments. You know, we live in the world. Part of our world that we live in includes government. We interact with the government. That's it. So as Christians living in the world under a government, it's wise to talk about how we interact with that government. Characteristics of a strong centralized government. By the way, before now was a critarchy. There's one in Somalia. Anybody want to go to Somalia right now? Okay. A critarchy is judges here and there, or a couple judges and non-centralized, more like states, okay, a little area here, a little area there, a little area. Now we're talking about a centralized and a strong centralized government. He's going to be able to take, if he's got the power to take, he's got power, which means he's strong, right? The power to, did you read that? Take, 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 take. All consuming, take it. And not only for him, but for his servants and for their servants also. This is beautiful, right? Characteristics of a strong But this refers to a monarchy. These abuses would never happen in a democratic republic system of government in which there are three branches specifically put in place for checks and balances. It would never happen. It happens. Let's skip the rest and go right to that. It happens.
Government.
It's what?
It's called government.
It's called government. Right. It's just this government. Look at the entity as one. It's a centrally located, strong government.
The God isn't the king. Nothing else matters.
Say it again?
If God isn't the king.
Yeah, if God isn't the king, that's the short of it.
And that's what brings all of them down.
Right. Yeah. The problem was not the system. They said, look, your sons are all messed up, so give us a new judge. Give us a whole new system. Sound familiar? Right? It wasn't the system, the monarchy. Oh, this will, the king will judge us. Ha! Consider the monarchy. They ended up, the monarchy led them off. And by the way, how did the end of Samuel's reign as judge, how did it end? Verse 13, the Philistines were subdued. They didn't come in anymore. Chapter 7, verse 13. Verse 14, the cities which the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored to Israel from Ekron even to Gath. Israel delivered their territory from the hand of the Philistines, so there was peace between Israel and the Amorites. Hey, not bad. So the point is that even with a judgeship, they could have what they want. The point, the problem is not the system, but the people of the system. The government, yeah?
Samuel was as close to a king as they got, because he traveled all over.
Yeah.
So he was like the judge for all of Israel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was close to him. Yeah, he wasn't king, but he was...
I would say he was like the judges.
Yes, but he was not just a local area.
No.
He was like all over.
Yeah.
He traveled all over.
Yeah, well, it's a central government, but it doesn't have the strong power that the king would have.
Right, he didn't have the power to take everything.
Right, here's one way to look at it. The king has the power. The king has a what? Military. The judge, did that judge have a military? What did he do? He called up all the tribes. That's the difference, okay? The king will have his military. He can go out and do whatever he wants to the tribes, right? The government setup would not ensure righteous judgment. Only the hearts of those in the government, whichever government it is. As you said, that's what brings us all down? No. Somebody's saying about, it's unless the Lord is the king, right? Now, the problem comes when rulers reject God's word. Since rulers always come from the people, the only way to maintain a healthy government is for the people themselves to maintain faith. Since this will not happen, has it ever happened? Do not put your faith in government and expect nations to fall, which in our case, if you're in a very wealthy and a very luxurious and very free country, expect it to go away sometime. Probably. Some of it, maybe not all of it, but expect those things just to go away. Now, this is not to say we should leave an absolutely defeatist attitude either. Oh, it's going to happen, so let's go. Let me ask you this. Boaters in a boat that are heading towards a waterfall. It's going to go over. So, I'm throwing my paddle away. If one person in that boat threw their paddle away, what would everybody else do with their paddles? Whack them. We're going to take a minute away from trying to paddle upstream, and we're going to whack this person to get sense back into them to say, look, right? Okay. If nothing else, what is our nation's fix right now? Our nation, and typically, what we have problems in this nation. What do our politicians do?
More regulations.
Get another law.
Yeah.
We'll fix everything with another law, another law. So, okay. No, not okay. But okay, let's go with another law. What should that law be? John, I love the way he prays this one thing that he prays all the time. Right? Tell people's injustices. Tell people. You don't have to be into politics. But tell people injustices will always remain if we do not make laws that go with God's laws. Thank you, John.
Yep.
I tried for years to figure out how to say that.
But the thing is, if we pray for this, we better want what that is, because God's law is a lot firmer than any of these nations' laws, even Gazars and whatever. There's only, you better be ready for that law.
Right.
If you do something wrong, you will be punished.
By the way, are we talking about politics here? Yeah, we are. Okay? I'll this, but to the same degree that Paul did, right? What does he say? First of all, I urge that entreaties and prayers and petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men for kings and all who are in authority. Why? So that we may live a tranquil and quiet life. That means that we can worship God the way we want to. And even more than that, okay, we have a quiet life in all godliness, which includes more than just worshiping. It means helping others who are in need, both spiritually and physically. And this is good and acceptable in the sight of a God of our Savior who desires all men to be saved. You live a quiet and tranquil life in all godliness. And the next thing you know, all people are being saved. What's the connection? That's right. They're praying that the king makes rules that allow us to go out and preach, because we're going to anyway. At least we had better. Right? And Paul, when it came to exercising his civil rights, what did Paul do? Every time. I exercise my... And in fact, the principle, it's not talking about politics. Actually, it kind of is. 1 Corinthians 7:21, if you're a slave, if you're called as a slave, that's great. But if you can, do it. Make it happen. Right? So these are principles that we all put together and say, look, we're not just lemmings or, you know, robots that can't do anything. You want
to
say something?
This is the biggest argument it seems like there is out there to make for the opportunity. I asked somebody who is unwilling to vote, well, do you try to influence the world you live in for good? And if this is still one of the ways you have to potentially do that, what is it about this that prevents you from doing this? Because what is characteristically different about this opportunity than any other opportunity you would have, you know, open the car door for an old lady or whatever it might be? I'm serious.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're going to come with an illustration,
yeah.
What is it about this one thing that makes it so different than every other attempt you're trying to make to influence the world for good? It's one of the more powerful ones you have.
Yeah.
You know?
And if you don't have to spend hours reading the politics page of the newspaper every day. If you can, great. But if nothing else, tell people that the injustices will always be here unless we make the right kind of laws. New laws aren't the answer. But if you're stuck on making new laws, then the right kind of laws that make that go with God's, if nothing else, say that and be prepared to give a defense for the hope that is within you. We could belabor this point. Okay.
Just, you know, we're talking about politics, but, you know, at least we think of Romans 15:4. These things are for our learning.
Right.
I mean, we've got to learn here. They made mistakes. Why did they make these mistakes? Because they turned from God. The government fell.
Right.
They had probably the greatest government in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Israel, in Solomon's day. But it fell. Why?
They rejected. Yeah. These things are written for our admonishment. And here is a huge one. Centralized government. A strong, powerful centralized government will take. You know, so if you want to talk about politics, go right to here. Mindy.
So what do you do? Vote for the lesser two evils?
You can... I'm not... We can talk about specific situations all the time. But there will always be the less of two evils because man is imperfect. There will always be the less of two evils, the lesser of two evils. So, yes. Now, to what degree? We should not argue from what are the exceptions, which nowadays are not so much the exceptions. Okay. Anything? Shall we continue or shall we?
Careful consideration.
Right.
Well, we certainly shouldn't vote for anybody who clearly opposes God's laws. And some of them do.
Right.
Yeah, just flat out do.
Right. We can go on. Yeah, George.
We just read Jonah the other day, and it occurred to me that it is such a shame that people in power, they have so much influence, and it could be used appropriately. And, you know, when the king of Nineveh repented, The nation of Nineveh repented.
Yeah.
You know. Well, you know, where did those people go?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we see that anymore? And God's law is so perfect the way it is, and it's the only one out there as a government type system in obedience to him that does not destroy the people it governs to sustain itself.
Right.
You know, and
what was the country you were just showing here a little while ago, that the ruler that prayed that prayer to turn towards God's law?
Oh.
You showed me that.
Yeah, it's South African.
Yeah, it was in Africa somewhere. It was amazing.
I'm moving there.
Yeah, the man said it's the third world country or whatever it is. This was last year, and the president of this country came out, destitute people, and said, homosexuality is our problem. We need to quit this. 3 days of prayer and fasting. I mean, he was all over it. He led a prayer on television and everything. I got to look it up again. There was a big article in the Times.
Yeah, right. Send it to me if you can remember. Okay. Very good. We can continue this discussion. Gary will answer all the questions. Chapter 9. There was a man named Benjamin, whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphia, the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor. He had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man. There was not a more handsome person than among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders up, he was taller than any of the people. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. You know the story. Verse 15, the day before Saul's coming, the Lord had revealed this to Samuel, saying, about this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Now this is interesting, because if you had asked Saul what was happening? I'm looking for my donkeys.
Right, that's right.
What was God doing? Steering him. I don't know how that works. And right, that's the point. God works in mysterious ways. I love saying that. You know, that's not in the Bible. Yes, it is. Not explicitly. Joseph dreams and his father's love, right? Rahab runs a place where people can stay without, no questions asked. You just come on in here. We don't ask questions. Samson and Delilah, love and lust. Saul's father loses his donkeys. This is so ordinary. This is so ordinary. I lost my key on the way here today. What's the point? You never know what he is doing with you. You never, ever know. So, Gary's tractor breaks down. He goes to town. What's going on? Yes, Gary, his tractor breaks down. Is it more? Could be. His soldier goes to buy eggs for Mrs. Martin. Tanya works overtime during the furlough. She was just talking to me about that. Jennifer goes to the hospital again. Shall we go on? Anybody else have something else that we can throw out there? I mean, just these things that happen to us ordinarily every day. John drives his bus. It goes on and on. Something a little funny might happen. Something might not happen. Now, we can never know what he is doing with you, but you always know what you are doing with him. And that's the only thing we can control. So as long as you're being who you ought to be always, well then, we don't need to know if God is using us specifically that time, but he is using us generally. Comments?
Why don't we refer to these as miracles again?
Yeah. Okay, chapter 9, not of Leviticus. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
I can't help but think, Saul. Think of Saul. He's like, what are you talking about? Sort of a wow moment.
Crazy old man.
Like, wow. I mean, why are you saying that to me? You know, like, do you know what you're saying? You know, can you imagine being Saul? Like, wow.
Yeah, which I think is the point of what's about to happen. I think it's more for Saul than anybody else. I could be wrong. But I mean, he leaves. I'm not even going to read that. You read it. He leaves, and boom, he's prophesying, and these people are doing these things, giving him stuff, and saying stuff to him, exactly like the prophet had said. And so the connection for Saul is, if he's right about these three things that happened, then he's not as crazy as, as he looks. Right? Verse 11 of chapter 10, it came about that when all who knew him previously saw that he verse 9, all those signs came to him. Verse 10, the Spirit of God came upon him mightily so that he prophesied among them. I mean, that, you know, they all, okay, everything that's happening, like this crazy old man told me, but this one, this is from God directly in him. And it says that, verse 9 says, changed his heart. Whatever that means, Saul knew it. Right? Saul knew what was happening. By the way, this will come up later on in Saul's life, and Saul will know what's happening again. Verse 11, what has happened to the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets? So other people know about this also, right? That turns out to be a saying. And he goes back and he didn't tell his uncle about what's going on. Verse 17, Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah. And he said to the sons of Israel, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I brought Israel up from Egypt and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the power of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But you have today rejected your God who delivers you from all your calamities and your distresses. Yet you have said, no, but set a king over us. Now, therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans. And then he finds Saul on down and on down to verse 24. Surely there is no one like him among all the people. So all the people shouted and said, long live the king. Doesn't that sound exciting? Isn't it going to be great?
Wait a minute. Saul is hiding. He's hiding. He's scared.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like, he realizes what's happening. He's like, he's scared.
Yeah, which I think is a sharp contrast for what is going to happen to Saul in the future.
How the power,
exactly, power corrupted him. He was a humble man. You read this, he's giving credit to the Lord, Jehovah. He's merciful. He's not killing the people. And then as you read some little glimpses of him, I'm not saying he's the most pious person ever here, but he isn't the person that he will be later on. So here they are, they're all shouting and saying, long live the king, and everything's going to be fantastic. And the first thing that happens is he has problems. Certain worthless men, verse 27, said, how can this one deliver us? And they despised him and did not bring him any present, but he kept silent. The first thing, they wanted a kingdom so that everything would go okay, and the first thing that happens are problems. It's amazing, right? When they did what they wanted, the problems began immediately. So, God knows best. Always stick with his plan. Just stick with it. Because when you start thinking, this is called the law of unintended consequences, right? Do you notice the type of government will never guarantee its perseverance, only the type of people? And here we have people who are messed up already, right? And some people are never satisfied. Give us a king, they said. And then when they got a king, some of them said, we want a different king. Right?
Well, isn't that the way it always was with people that are in authority? There's always some that are questioning.
Oh, of course.
They're always attacking them and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And especially the worthless men.
Right.
You're right, though. If somebody's in authority, somebody is going to be picking. In authority or any position of envy.
Right.
Whatever, authority or not. John Moore.
He knows he gives another opportunity to repent. Verse 19, he said, I delivered you. Now you want this instead. You reject me. They could have at that point said, wait.
Right.
Instead they say, long live the king.
In chapter 12, it's too late. They can't go back. Yeah, good point. So whatever they receive, whether they ask for it or not, they will find something to complain about. Some people are just like that. May that not be me. Right? Saul, we pointed this out, Saul is humble. He's hiding. He's almost cowardly. He's definitely not taking his spear and whipping it at people at the dinner table. He keeps silent. Let them, Paul said, look, these people say they despised him and did not bring him any present, but he kept silent, as opposed to, I'm the king, you're going to bring me a present or I'm chopping off your head, which is what he probably would have done. Now, they ask the question, how can this one deliver us? That's chapter 11. Comments or questions, we'll stop there for tonight. He is.
That's like a guy in it,
yeah, that's right. Tall, dark, and handsome.
Samuel kind of convicts him right there in verse 19. Today you've rejected your God who saves you from all your calamities and your distresses, and you've said to him, set a king over us. Now, therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your thousands. I think I'd have been pretty nervous right there. I mean, because he's used that in their history before.
Yep.
Okay, show up. We're going to figure out where to pin the blame.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
Go home.
Yeah. Okay.